I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. It's often pointed out that the United States imprisons more of its population than any other country in the world. Michael Jacobson looks into the matter in his new book, Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration. Mr. Jacobson has had substantial experience within the penal system. He served three mayors as the commissioner of the New York City Department of Correction and Probation and then deputy budget director of the City of New York. These days, he is the president of the Vera Institute of Justice, professor of criminology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and also professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center. His book is published by New York University Press, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Michael Jacobson to my show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So with all those jobs, when did you find time to write a book?
Well, academia sort of gives you the time to write a book, and when I left the corrections job in the beginning of 1998 up until about a few months ago, I was a full professor at CUNY. And one of the nice things about being a professor is it gives you some time to sort of think about things, be contemplative, and write, and that's what I did.
How do we compare? We say that we imprison more of our population than other countries in the world. What's the next worst?
The next worst is probably Russia. Russia used to actually be a little ahead of us. And then they ran into some pretty stark financial problems over the last few years, and they've had several large amnesties. And so we're ahead of Russia now. But just to give you a sense, when you add jails and prisons, we imprison about 700 per 100,000 people. Russia is probably around 600. But most countries, say, in Western Europe hover in about the 100 to 150 range. So we're many multiples above most post-industrialized countries.
Were we ever in that 150 range?
Yeah.
Is this a trend?
In historical terms, it's a relatively recent trend. Up until the mid to late 60s, we were with most other countries in Western Europe. And in the last 40 years or so, we've been on what a lot of people call an imprisonment binge. And we've gone from having 250,000 people in prisoner jail in 1980 to the current 2.2 million 25 years later.
Does this reflect a change in philosophy or just a change in legislation?
Well, I think they are connected. I think the change in philosophy has been one that's been less and less concerned with rehabilitation, especially as the politics of punishment has more leaned toward retribution and punitiveness. And along with that sort of philosophical change has come legislative change, and that's in the form of longer and longer and harsher and more mandatory sentences, and here we are today.
But weren't we pioneers in the rehabilitative approach? If I remember correctly, Sing Sing changed the world. Everybody came to see all of the wonderful things that Sing Sing was bringing to American prisons.
We were, and it's hard to remember now, but if you would ask, if you just did a poll of the American public and this recently as 1965, and you said, what's the point? What's the purpose of putting people in prison? Almost everyone would have said rehabilitation. That's what prisons were about. But a series of both political events, including urban riots, more drug use, the move by the right to successfully sort of take charge of the crime issue, the political capital in crime, some work around the declining success of rehabilitation programs. A lot of things sort of happened simultaneously, and in an incredibly short period of time, our whole purpose of why and how we imprison people changed pretty dramatically.
Well, in New York State, most people blame the Rockefeller drug laws for being the chief reason, but obviously they only apply to New York State, and yet this is a national trend.
Oh, it's a huge national trend. And even in New York State, the Rockefeller drug laws were an important reason for the increase in our population, but by no means the only reason. But nationally, there's not one state in this country over the last 25 years that hasn't significantly increased its jail populations and prison populations. That being said, there's huge variations among the states.
So there are states that are not banning TV rights or keeping prisoners out of weight rooms or preventing them from getting an education?
Well, that's the trend in most states, frankly. But again, because when you talk about prisons generally, you're talking about people in state prisons, right? We have a federal prison system. It has about 160,000 people. It's a very big system in that system. But 1.2 million or 4 million or so people are in state prisons. And that's where you see a huge variation in issues like weightlifting and food and health care.
Some people hate the idea that someone goes to prison and has color TV and can go to the gym
right.
when they're working 50, 60 hours a week just to survive.
Sure. And, it's important to understand those politics. And at one level, that's understandable. You know, why are you spending money on people in prison? They're convicted felons. Why are you giving them job training? My kid doesn't get job training. And on one level, you can sort of intuitively understand those. But there are very good explanations for all of them in purely public safety terms. But I think what's really important for people to understand about prison, and I have these conversations with folks all the time about weightlifting or recreation, is that being in prison, being in a place where you have given up total control of your life and body, where you're at the complete whim of the state that tells you when and where to eat, when and where to go to the bathroom, who you can see and not see, that is the huge punishment associated with prison. And whether you have a TV in that environment at the end of the day is pretty meaningless.
Well, I guess the fear for some people is they see these pictures of these weightlifters with a lot of tattoos and they think, well, when that guy gets out of prison, he's going to be very threatening.
Right. You know, the other side of that, and again, it's understandable. The other side of that is that one of the reasons superintendents and people who run prisons like weightlifting equipment, right? Not free weights because those can be used as weapons, but the universal type machines you see in gyms, is because inmates who do a lot of exercise have a lot less stress, they're a lot less violent, they keep themselves busy, they're sort of tired after lifting weights for 5 hours. So there's a huge upside to that, but they do get big and muscular. But the fact of prison life is that if you work inside one of those places, there are so many more prisoners than there are staff that whether some of them are bulked up a little or not at the end of the day also is pretty meaningless.
Do people tend to have committed the same crimes, whether they're in the federal, the state, or the city prisons?
Largely in all those systems, we're talking about drug crimes. 60% of everyone in a federal prison has been convicted of some sort of drug crime. And in state prisons around the country, the fastest growing type of crime that people are convicted for revolves around drugs of some sort.
Well, whites and blacks use drugs in this country. I just heard a report today on methamphetamine being a real problem in rural white America.
Right.
And yet the prisons are predominantly populated by black prisoners.
Right, and that's one of the many litany of criticisms, the legitimate one of prisons, is that they're hugely disproportionately minority. And the drug issue is a good way to illustrate that. Most studies show that illegal drug use, the rates of illegal drug use, are very similar for whites and blacks, yet many, many more blacks and Latinos are in prison than white. So one of the reasons I think there's so much more attention to this issue, aside from the growth and the use that prisons serve, is the clear fact that racially and ethnically they're hugely used disproportionately.
For what is this just simply a way? Is this just institutional racism? Are you saying?
Well, there's a lot of work that's done on this, and right, some of the explanations are it's institutional racism. Why else would it exist? There are other works that will say, well, no, this is who law enforcement can catch because whites, in the suburbs, can use and buy and sell drugs in a way that's a lot less visible to enforcement than in the cities. It's more visible where more minorities live, and I think some of that is true, but.
But the laws also have been skewed, as people pointed out, when crack cocaine got much stronger sentences than straight cocaine.
Exactly. And there are a host of these kinds of laws that inevitably affect people who live in cities overwhelmingly and those who live in cities in the poorest neighborhoods who tend to be disproportionately white or black. Simply the laws around toughening up sentences for people who sell drugs, for instance, near schools. Well, in large urban areas, every place is near a school. So if you live in a city, which automatically means that you're going to be have largely minority populations, if that's the law of the state, then people who are caught selling drugs in a city, in an inner city neighborhood, for example, are inevitably going to serve longer sentences than some white kid in the suburbs who happens to be selling drugs, but they're 2 miles from a school because there's just not that many schools.
My guest is Michael Jacobson, who's written a book called Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration. And you worked, as I said earlier, for 3 administrations here in New York City, Koch, Dinkins, and Giuliani.
Correct.
Administrations that have very different philosophies. What was their response to your saying things like this to them, or is this something that you've only come to since you've become an academic?
No. I mean, I think my thinking on this has become a little more wide-ranging than when I actually worked in government. But when I was the correction commissioner, I was the probation commissioner for Mayor Dinkins and probation and correction for Mayor Giuliani. He was actually pretty supportive of policies in the jails that provided treatment and alternatives to incarceration. I don't think, unlike his feelings about welfare reform or policing, for which he had very strong sort of ideological feelings, I think he was happy dealing with a lot of the corrections issues on the merits because he just hadn't, I don't think, as do most people, spent a lot of time thinking about it. So surprisingly, in New York City, the jail population decreased dramatically while Mayor Giuliani was the mayor. I'm not sure.
And people would be surprised to learn that.
That's correct. It's very counterintuitive. And I think even Mayor Giuliani, had you said before he became mayor, you know what's going to happen during the 8 years you are mayor, the jail population is going to go from 23,000 to about 15,000. I'm sure he also would have said,
wow,
no way that's going to happen. And I don't think he actually intended for it to happen. But it happened for a variety of factors, not the least of which is when the police department sort of changed their enforcement strategies and concentrated on misdemeanors, that just had a sort of domino effect of keeping people in jail for shorter periods of time than they would have otherwise.
Also, crack cocaine use went down. Demographics changed. There were fewer young people. So many people pointed out that affected crime rates throughout the country. But what's been the impact of all the revelations from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo? Do you think it has any effect on the way Americans think about prisoners who aren't labeled terrorists?
Well, one would hope. You know, the Vera Institute of Justice, which I direct, is running a national commission on prison and abuse in America's prisons to examine exactly that question. What do we know about the levels of abuse? How much abuse is there? What's the cause of it? What can we do about it? Because my sense from both Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo are, despite the fact that Americans clearly have been historically over the last generation gotten more and more punitive in terms of their use of prison, the fact that really significant violent abuse can happen in prison is pretty shocking, and I think people really care about that. To that extent, I think it's focused some really good attention on that issue.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about reform, parole, probation. I hadn't thought much about parole and probation, didn't realize that they were 2 different things, in fact. My guest is Michael Jacobson, whose book, Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration, is published by New York University Press. Mr. Jacobson is president of the Vera Institute of Justice, professor of criminology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center. Stay with us. We are back with Michael Jacobson, who has served 3 mayors of New York City as the commissioner of the New York City Department of Correction and Probation, and then deputy budget director of the City of New York. Now he is the president of the Vera Institute of Justice and also teaches criminology and sociology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and at the CUNY Graduate Center. And he's written a book called Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration, published by NYU Books. We have come to the whole matter of reform. We were talking earlier about giving up on rehabilitation. Are we saying when we give somebody, sentence someone to the death penalty, let's say, or even a life sentence without a chance of parole, that society sees absolutely no hope that this person will be able to reform?
Certainly with those sentences, we're saying that. And again, there's been a move in this country away from rehabilitation generally. So even when we put people in jail or prison for relatively short periods of time, you know, 4 to 5 years, which, believe me, is not short if you're in there, we've come to use prisons simply as places to warehouse people, and it's all about punishment now.
And then we let them out, and as in this case that we've just been reading about, people often just go out and commit more crimes. Sometimes they're let out of prison and commit a crime immediately afterward.
Correct. And that's
and then, of course, then we say, well, why did we let them out in the first place?
Right. Right. But the reality is about 95% of people you put in prison are going to get out of prison. And that's simply always going to be the case. We're never going to have the resources or the political will, thankfully, to keep everyone in prison forever. So recognizing that people do get out and that almost everyone who goes in goes out, state policymakers, legislatures now are starting to pay a lot of attention to this exactly because of that recidivism issue. Because right now, more than one out of every two people who gets out of prison is back in prison within 3 years.
Aren't there certain crimes that are more likely to be recidivist? For example, child molesters, rapists, sex crimes in general, because they stem out of some kind of a psychological thing. Drugs can be kicked.
Right. You know, it's interesting because when you look at the recidivism statistics, a lot of them are pretty counterintuitive. And in fact, the folks who recidivate the least and who commit the lowest rates of violent crime are people who are convicted of violent crimes. The people who have the most recidivism, the highest recidivism rates, are people who are in for property or drug crimes, because those tend to be sort of economic opportunities. They're essentially de facto jobs that people go back to when they're released from prison. People,
they go back to their old community and they're in the same situation they were in before.
Right. So the reason there's a lot of work around what's been termed prisoner reentry now is this recognition that people are ill prepared to get out of prison. When they do get out, they go back to the same places in which they got in trouble in the first place. And not surprisingly, they're rearrested at rates of 60% to 70%, and they're back in prison at rates of 50%. And that's both incredibly costly and at the same time is incredibly bad for public safety.
What are the effects of imprisonment on the communities people come out of?
They're pretty substantial, and there's been some interesting research done by Todd Clear, John Jay, and Dina Rose, which shows that in some communities that have huge numbers of people going to jail or prison, you actually reach a tipping point where you start to cause more crime than you save, because you've so destabilized these communities in terms of making two-parent families one-parent families, increasing the use of foster care, kids finding their way into the juvenile justice system. So prison is a resource that's so punitive and so expensive that it should be used as sparingly, as parsimoniously, as intelligently as we can use it, and not just the wild overuse that we have today.
As alternatives to incarceration, you propose community or restorative justice programs.
Right.
How would they work?
And well,
are they being implemented in any states?
They are, and they're programs that are make sense for some folks and not for others. You know, we're not talking about violent criminals here are people who rape and murder, but a lot of property crime, for instance, are crimes where both the community and the victim want to be restored, right? They're less interested in punishment than
when you say property crime, you
right.
mean somebody who's robbed a local liquor store?
Right, burgles a house, takes some property, steals a car.
Robs $1 billion from his company or
Well, I think that's a different issue, frankly, because that kind of sophisticated white-collar sort of Tyco-like crime, I think, rises to a level of seriousness far above someone who has no money stealing some food from a bodega. They're both property crimes, but I would argue incredibly different responses are warranted to those things.
And yet the general sense is that those crimes are treated a lot more leniently. Michael Milken comes out and he's obviously got pretty much all the money that he accrued for whether he should have or not gotten that money or not. It's beside the point. He went to jail for getting it.
Right.
So if somebody said to me, you can have $10 billion if you go to jail for a couple of years, I might very well take that offer.
No, exactly, which is why, you know, Martha Stewart is not the typical person coming out of her prison. You know, we don't have to worry about her reentry or she'll be fine.
Well, she only was caught for a couple of $1,000, went to jail for a lot more than many of these billionaire
correct.
Guys.
And, you know, the issue, again, one of the common criticisms you get of our use of the prison system is that they're so full of people who have done sort of street-level crimes as opposed to corporate crimes. And, again, that's a legitimate criticism. There's a whole range of reasons for that, including law enforcement resources and the difficulty of ferreting out those kinds of crimes. But in some ways, that's a separate argument apart from the fact that we overuse prison. It's probably true that there are some people, most notably white-collar criminals, who aren't in prison who should be. But it's also true that there are many more people now in prison who either shouldn't be or should be in for shorter periods of time or can be more safely and more efficiently supervised in the community than they can in a prison.
And what would those kinds of programs involve?
Well, it depends. A lot of times, simply keeping someone on close community supervision that entails getting them off drugs and getting them ready to have a job makes far more sense in purely public safety terms. This isn't a cost issue. It results in less cost. But when you look at why people go to prison or jail or the state of their job and education levels when they get in jail, hard to get around the fact that folks who are off drugs and are working go to jail at much lower rates. So if you want to increase public safety, you are naturally going to be more interested in spending some time and money making sure someone is ready for the world of work and getting off drugs than simply putting them in prison and waiting till they get out.
How much of New York State's budget is dedicated to the criminal justice system?
New York's prison budget probably is over $3 billion. It's pretty significant. It's probably around 3% or so. But again, states vary on this. New York does not have one of the larger shares of its budget taken up by corrections. You have a place like California, which has a $7 billion prison system out of about over $100 million budget. And you have a place like Michigan, where almost 20% of the state budget goes for prisons. That's just huge.
I imagine that's a lot more than they spend on education or health care.
Sure. And what's happened across the country is as prisons have grown and grown, they have almost by design taken money away from those areas. You simply, in an era of declining resources, you can't fund everything. And a lot of the funding for prisons has come at the cost of education and health care programs.
And then some people might say the reason we're incarcerating more people is because we've denied them those other services.
Right. No, this is a huge circular issue that a lot of folks, myself including, are arguing if you made resource shifts, even marginal resource shifts, away from institutional corrections, prisons and jails, into more community-based programs or into strengthening communities themselves, you will wind up achieving more public safety and have more money to fund those areas which are so crucial in the first place.
My guest is Professor Michael Jacobson. His book, Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration, from New York University Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. You talked earlier about things being counterintuitive and suggested that there's a surprising relationship between crime rates and incarceration.
Right. And if you just look generally over the last 10 years, which a lot of people do, you'll see that the number of people we've put in prison has gone up and crime nationally has gone down. So a number of folks just make that causal relationship. But it's important to look at it, first of all, in larger historical terms, because there have been periods in U.S. history, even over the last 40 years, where crime rates have gone up as well as prison has gone up. So, you know, if prison is responsible for crime going down in the last 10 years, was prison use responsible for crime going up 15 years earlier? Not necessarily. They're very complicated relationships. And some of the most interesting relationships to look at are individual-state relationships. So New York has one of the slowest growing prison systems in the country. And in fact, in the last 5 or 6 years, our prison system has shrunk, and we have by far the largest decrease in crime in the nation. And you have other states like West Virginia, which have had huge increases, massive increases in their prison population, and almost no reduction in crime. So the relationship is very complicated, and people shouldn't assume that if you build up your prison population, you'll automatically get crime reduction.
So is New York one of the more enlightened states?
I think it has I think it has less to do with being enlightened than although the recent reform around the Rockefeller drug laws notwithstanding, although it obviously wasn't the reform a lot of people wanted. It was a lot of people were amazed that New York was even able to achieve that. I think it's less that New York is enlightened than what's happened in New York City, which is that we send far less people to prison now than we ever used to, again, because the police are concentrating so much on public order, quality of life sort of offenses, and there's less crime, so we send less people to prison. That has driven down our prison population.
Do you think our gun laws have anything to do with that?
Well, again, it's a rare state that doesn't have a fair number of penalties for sending people to prison for the use or possession of guns. New York, as you know, is obviously one of the more liberal states. We have very tight gun control laws here, although we had those laws in effect when we also had a lot more crime. So it's complicated.
You list six obstructions to reducing prison populations: the politics of punishment, which we've talked about, prisons as economic development, private prisons, correction unions, a recidivism rate, which we discuss as a barrier to reform, and the budget process. So can we talk about some of the other things? Private prisons, for example. New York State doesn't have as many private prisons as many states. You think that's one of the other reasons we don't have some of the problems they face?
Well, I think private prisons really tend to complicate the issue, and Governor Pataki has said that, at least while he's been the governor, which is true, there will be no private prisons in New York State, and that's largely because our corrections unions here are very powerful, especially the city union headed by Norman Seabrook. The real issue for private prisons for me, and the reason I list it as one of the barriers to reform, is because when you introduce sort of private business, private capital into the prison business, it's another motivating factor for people to increase incarceration, because these companies are incredibly sophisticated, and what they want is more and more market share. And the way they get more and more market share is to have more and more prisoners. And the way to get more and more prisoners is to have tougher and tougher laws that imprison more people. So they're very sophisticated about lobbying for those laws.
They're in the state legislatures. Then you say correction unions. Right. They also need to have a growing prison population because that their jobs depend on it. Prisons as economic development, that's many small towns,
sure,
that are facing economic difficulties see a prison as a growth economy.
Absolutely.
Thing.
In this country, we use, sadly, prisons as our primary form of rural economic development. Then you can certainly see that in some of the upstate sort of North Country areas in New York. You know, towns across the country in these rural areas fight for prisons the way New York City is fighting for the Olympics. They are seen as a big economic boon to their communities.
In the brief time we have left to us, let's talk about the crux of your book, which is reforming the parole system and how it can drastically reduce prison populations. First of all, when was the parole system implemented? Is that a fairly recent thing?
Well, it's been in effect in one way or another for over a century here. It's simply that the numbers have grown so hugely because we have so many more people in prison now. So we have about 700,000 to 750,000 people a year under some form of parole or post-prison supervision.
And who How well-funded is the parole system?
Oh, it's horribly funded. That's one of the reasons I spent a fair amount of time on this in the book, even though it's at one level sort of mundane inside baseball part of the criminal justice system, because most people, the huge increases in the number of people going to prison have been driven by those who fail on parole. The increase in people going back to prison for being a failure on parole is about 8 times higher than people going to prison for the first time. And one of the reasons for that is that those agencies are so poorly funded that they can't keep track of folks, they can't provide them any services.
Gee, it's not what I've seen on television on Street Time. It seemed like the parolees were really tightly controlled.
Some are. You know, if what most states do, understandably, is that with the limited resources they have, they really watch very closely folks like sex offenders, right? Makes sense, those who have been in prison for violent crimes. But by and large, parole caseloads across the country are so enormous now that most agencies can essentially keep track of who's on parole but provide very little for them in terms of the reasons they went to prison in the first place.
How does parole differ from probation?
Well, you don't get onto parole unless you've already been in prison, right? Parole is a form of release once you've served some time in prison. Probation is an alternative to prison, right? You can be convicted of a felony, usually a nonviolent felony, and the judge will make the determination that you can be supervised in the community. And in fact, when you look at the numbers on probation and parole, almost 4 million people on probation, 700 or so thousand on parole, you have 2.5 times the number of people on probation and parole than you do in jail and prison.
I knew someone who was on parole for drug charges, and it was impossible for him to get himself going. He was he came out of a middle-class family, but nonetheless couldn't get a job. Eventually, he said he was set up by somebody who asked him to help get some drugs, and he needed the money.
Sure. And again, when you look at people who are coming out of prison and the incredibly high levels of drug use, alcohol use, mental illness, homelessness, and you look at the problems they have and you combine them with what people are supposed to do on parole, get a job, stay off drugs, have a stable address, it's immediately apparent that there's a disconnect between what people can do when they come out of prison and what they're expected to do.
Are there any states that we should try to model ourselves on, or are there any other countries that have systems that you think we should admire?
Well, you know, it's always problematic, especially politically, when you start talking about other countries like Sweden or Finland, because the comparisons are sort of interesting and fallacious at some level.
They have much more homogeneous cultures.
But what's interesting around the country now is not necessarily there being a model state, but that states all over the country are paying a lot of attention to this issue now because they just don't have the money at this level to keep incarcerating people, and because it's clear that we're spending the money in a way that buys us a 50% recidivism rate.
Michael Jacobson is the president of the Vera Institute of Justice, professor of criminology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center, formerly a commissioner of the New York City Department of Correction and Probation, and also deputy budget director for the City of New York. His book, Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration, is published by New York University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you again for having me.